Hello, everybody, and welcome back to yet another Science Studio program. My name's Keith Pannell. I'm here in the studio today with Russ Chianelli, and we're going to be continuing a little bit with a discussion that we had last week on statistics. That is the Benjamin Disraeli quotation, lies, damn lies, and statistics. Well, we're going to be talking to a statistician who's actually this week in a department of statistics, as opposed to last week where it was in a department of psychology. And our guest today is Mindy McCann. She's from Oklahoma State University. And so, Mindy, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So tell us, first of all, how you, Mindy, became a statistician. When you were a little girl, is that what you dreamed of doing?
Or?
No. So let's start where you were suddenly understanding there was a possible career in this statistics or science or whatever it was.
Well, when I was in high school, I was very, very interested in math. And so I thought that that was something I wanted to be doing, that I wanted to be doing something in mathematics.
Were you good at it?
And yes,
that's why you were interested
well,
in it?
I was good at a lot of things, I like to say.
But, good girl.
I was good at math, yes. Not only good at it, but enjoyed it. So
good.
Those are, you know, you have both of those things together. That's a good thing.
Lovely.
And so I participated in, we had a mathematics club, and we used to go to little contests. So our high school would compete against other mathematics clubs in little contests. And when I was probably a sophomore in high school, I showed up one Saturday morning to go to the math club contest. And my advisor, one of my math teachers, said, "You're in the statistics test this time." I don't remember what all else I was competing in, but you competed in different areas. And so whoever was doing the statistics was sick that day or not available or whatever, and they put me in the statistics test. And I said, "Well, I haven't done anything in that area. I haven't studied. I don't know anything about it." She goes, "Well, I don't care. I need someone in there, and you're going to go take it." And I said, "Well, okay. Well, I found the problems really interesting. I actually did pretty well. I think I got a third or a fourth, which with no study was pretty good. And I really was intrigued by the problems on the exam. So that got my interest started. And then I investigated it. And I originally started out my undergraduate career thinking I would be an actuary because that was, you know, what when I looked up statistics, that was what came up. So I took a lot of business classes, but it didn't take long before my advisor started me on the research bug, and then I had to switch gears. I couldn't go into
okay. So you went away and got a PhD and all the rest of it
in statistics.
What was your thesis about?
It was about multiple comparison. So it was a way to adjust, for instance, if we have a whole bunch of drugs that we're trying to test. Maybe we have 7 or 8 different drugs that we want to test, and we want to try to end up at the end of the experiment with an overall conclusion, like drug 1 is the best, drug 2 is the next best, we can't tell a difference between 3 and 4, and then the rest are all in another, the worst group. Generally, when I graduated, the way to perform an experiment like that would have been to look at individual pairwise combinations and make decisions. And if you just do that one at a time, then the error rate for that overall conclusion that this is the best drug, this is the second best drug, and so on, isn't quite right. And so my dissertation ended up with a new method for doing that that was very general and allowed for less assumptions than any of the methods that had been previous.
What kind of assumptions? Why don't you go through that a little bit? What assumptions are eliminated?
The usual assumptions would be that the groups are independent of each other, okay? And then so that assumption was gone. We would not require independence anymore. We would allow any kind of dependent structure that you wanted. So the usual setting is independence. There are also a lot of solutions to that particular problem when you're willing to assume certain fixed kinds of dependence that show up a lot. My method didn't require any of that. Any dependent structure you want, we could utilize. There's also a lot of methods that do what are called stepwise procedures for the problem, which just come back with a set of this one is better than this one is better than this one, etc., but don't give you a set of intervals. And my procedure also gave you a set of intervals. So You know, the way I like to think of it is, if I come back to a researcher and tell them drug one is better than drug two, the very next thing they're going to ask me is how much better. Stepwise, multiple comparison stepwise procedures don't allow you to do that, other than the point estimate. They don't give you a confidence interval for how different that is. And so my procedure also gave you a confidence interval for that. And that is also important. One of the things in science that we've been hearing about lately is a big, somewhat revolt against p-values and significance testing. There's lots of people that are against that now. And one of the reasons is because in a theory setting, we can prove that if the difference between treatment one and treatment two is, as long as it's not zero, let's say it's 0.00001, if I have enough data, that will be statistically significant. Now, for that small
amount.
Okay,
just run back, though, what that number means.
What number means?
Well, you said 0.001.
Well, there's a difference
0.2.
Between, so generally, when we're trying to test, are two treatments the same, the null hypothesis is that the difference in the two means is zero. So let's suppose the difference isn't zero, but it's very small, 0.0001.
Right. And so okay. The conclusion there would be, really, it doesn't matter
exactly.
Which treatment. But as soon as you put it out there to a million people taking a drug, like Vioxx, as it was pointed out earlier, then now all of a sudden that little number becomes a big number.
Well, you're talking about the error rate. What I'm saying here is that when we're doing a hypothesis test for that difference, if I have enough data and that is
the
true
difference. Becomes significant.
Right. And so an issue with that significance there is that is practical significance and statistical significance can be different. So I might be able to prove that the mean lifetime for light bulb A is 2 minutes longer than the mean lifetime for light bulb brand B. But does anybody care? 2 minutes is not. So
right.
The reason that I did confidence intervals in my dissertation is because I wanted people to be able to assess, okay, I've told you one is better, but here's how much better. So now you can decide if that is really of interest to you or not, if the researcher really cares about that.
That's one thing about light bulbs, you know, and then people making their own individual choices. What about medications, though? Because then now you've got to worry about the FDA, because individual people don't make their choices for this drug or that drug usually. I mean, some of them are just not allowed and others are. How does your research relate to choice of drugs on the market, for example?
Well, there would be a lot of different ways that could be related. I would consider there to be two main different situations where this would apply. And one is in the difference between a hypothesis test and a confidence interval. And the other is in this multiplicity idea and reproducibility of experiments. And so those are separate issues.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is related to, as I was talking about, the light bulb. When we do an FDA experiment for a drug, they usually have in mind ahead of time a threshold, if you will, about what is going to be, how they've defined, what does it mean if drug A is more effective than drug B? It's not just greater than zero. It must be more than, you know, 0.05 bigger than zero.
Okay.
So that would allow you to, now if you have a confidence interval, you can see if that number's in there or not. If you just have a hypothesis test, generally those just say, is it greater than zero or less than zero? And so that is one issue. The other issue about the reproducibility has to do with the issue of multiple comparisons, which is that if we do many different comparisons, if we do many different tests, say we do 1,000 tests, and they're all with an error rate of 0.05, then even if every single one of them should reject, there's still going to be 5% of the 1,000 that are going to be false positives. And so if we are looking at a group of data as a whole, we need to try to adjust for that multiplicity because if we don't, we're going to be chasing after a lot of false positives. And from the research arena, if you think about that, if we had 50 different scientists in 50 different universities all investigating the same drug, it's likely one of them would say there was a difference because it would just be the 5% error rate. And so that's an issue.
That's
that
where
we
expert
have
witnesses come from, right?
We have an issue as a science community. That's an issue for us when we're looking at the whole big picture.
Just before we leave the topic, the whole idea of North America being risk averse. And so, you know, people don't want to have this 0.5 feature. They want a 0.00 probability that there's a problem. Statisticians and scientists and people in general have got to get the message across that life is full of risk, right? I mean, and so therefore, how do we deal with that?
Well, I used to have to fight this when I taught engineering statistics, because the engineers, when we would run a hypothesis test and I would start talking about the error rate is going to be 0.05, they were all like, that's not acceptable. I can't live my life with an error rate of 0.05. I'm like, well, you're going to have to, because we can't run a test that has a zero error rate. That's not possible. And so I would have to talk to them about that. When you're talking about sample data, you're not going to be able to be 100% certain that you make the right decision. That's an issue in my profession. That's just the way it works.
One of the things that really interests me is that in the field of environmental sciences, a lot of the information is based upon non-statistics and political opinions and so on and so forth. And I saw a case the other day, which I thought was fascinating. Okay, it was about the dust bowls, which are caused by droughts. So these guys were talking about the dust bowl was in the 30s in the United States and different places in the world. And they went all the way back to Roman times, where they were predicting droughts based upon the literature. I don't know if you've ever seen that. But there was in, 450 AD, there was a big drought in northern Italy, and they got it from the literature. And so their statistics was based upon reading the literature and then calculating the size of the drought from geography. And over the years, they had good predictions for when the dust bowls would occur. And I thought that was a bit of a stretch going back to 400 AD, or maybe it was 900 AD.
So what's that going to do with the program?
Well, they had a statistical analysis, which I can't remember the name of it, that they said they applied to that data, which made it correct.
And so they can now make prediction.
Yes.
And so this is Tom Gill predicting where the next dust bowl is going to be?
Right.
And where is it going to be?
Well, I don't know. There was some bad jokes about that. It also had to do with the delta T between the Pacific and the Atlantic.
Which in terms of temperature.
Yeah.
All right.
Cause these swirls.
Well, that's all very interesting. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. That was Russ Chianelli. And we're talking to Professor Mindy McCann, and she's from the Department of Statistics at Oklahoma State University. And we've been talking about all sorts of things like multiple comparisons being better than one-on-one. We'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russell Chianelli, and Professor Mindy McCann from Oklahoma State University and the Department of Statistics there. Many, many people have to use statistics. I mean, you can't get around using it in your own life. You know, you make bets, right? I mean, I like to bet on horses, all right? And so you look back at the past record and you make a future prediction. So statisticians are all over the place. They're particularly common in math departments and statistics departments, but from my knowledge, because my son is one, statisticians or people studying statistics within psychology is a big group of people, and also, as you probably know, in colleges of businesses too. What's different between the approach to statisticians in these different locations?
Well,
can you see anything that you can relate to us? They've got a different attitude or different training,
Well, I think it depends, because sometimes they have very different trainings. We have lots of people at my university, Oklahoma State University. I often have will tell someone in the community that I teach statistics at OSU, and they'll say, oh, do you know blah, 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 blah. He teaches statistics also. And my department is small. There's only 10 of us. So if I don't recognize the person, they don't teach statistics. Now, they probably teach a statistics course through the education department or through psychology or through some other department. And I'm not saying they don't do a good job of teaching their course. But most of those people do not have statistics training. What has happened is that they... Now, some of them do, and so those, and I view those as two very different situations. But most of the ones at my university don't have statistics training. Instead, they have training in their individual discipline, in psychology or in education, and they have just been the top of the heap quantitatively in their particular cohort, in their particular field. And so they do have lots of quantitative skills.
So why is there this feature? Because we see it in chemistry. I mean, we have a tough class. I don't teach it. I don't even understand it properly. Physical chemistry. But engineers need to know physical chemistry. They're always pushing to have a special class. And then they even hire people to teach physical chemistry, but in engineering. And we say, oh, that's because they're not really going into the depth significantly. So how can they possibly understand it? Do you have that same caveat, or are you more politically correct and say, oh, it's okay for them because that's what they need, but that's not really statistics?
I think it depends. I certainly see the benefit and even the need to have other disciplines as far as statistics is concerned, to talk about the specific things that, because there are some statistical procedures that are more commonly used in certain disciplines and not so much in others.
Well, is that because they're easier to handle? Is there an intellectual justification?
There are some.
Okay.
So, and that's a good reason. And I can also see the fact that, you know, the students tend to learn better if they have examples and scenarios that are things that they see that I'm going to need to do this. You know, when I teach an introductory statistics class, they're all over the examples that deal with looking up things on Google or their cell phones or, you know, the difference between light and regular beer. I mean, anything like that, they're all interested in that. So
you actually teach the difference between light and regular beer.
I use that as an example to do a T-test, you know, because if the subject matter is something that students
I'd
all
be interested
work up
in.
There, I,
so what statistical analysis are you doing applying to different beers?
Well, I would just have to say, okay, what's the difference in the taste? So I would have to go find someone else who's done the experiment, and then statistically I would talk about analyzing the data. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just being creative and trying to find examples of data sets that I think the students will be interested in the data sets themselves, and so then say, oh, yes, statistics is important.
You know, that's interesting because you talk about multiple comparisons. I used to play poker a lot. And I had a whole bunch of friends that would come over to the house, or we'd go to their house, and we'd always drink beer. But different people would buy different beers. And I was cheap. In those days, there was a drink called Texas Pride. It was the cheapest beer that I could get. And everybody, oh, it's terrible and terrible. But then I did an interesting test. I got about 10 different types of beer, but using ones I knew they wouldn't like, Heineken, Bass, you know, different foreign beers. And the only American beer was Texas Pride. And they all chose, in this blind test, Texas Pride was the one to drink because, you know, you can play all sorts of games.
Well, now it's Ace, made in Brooklyn by Brooklyn Brewery.
Is that right?
Ace.
Ace.
For it. I'm a wine drinker, well, it's not a beer drinker.
Well, but you know, then it brings up, you know, Robert Parker and these wine ratings are the same thing. You know, something
94 here and a 92 there. And,
yeah.
It's all subjective, I suppose, right?
That's well, one of the things that's interesting me right now is pensions. So if you have a pension savings, okay, many people have a wealth person that buys stock and bonds for them. And now there are machines that are doing it, you know, placing the bets. So when you talk about, you know, buying stocks and bonds, is a machine better or a person?
See, I don't, as a statistician, I get to not have an opinion on that. Because my job would be to try to find data that was collected in an equitable manner and that measures what you really want to assess as better. So we'd have to have a discussion if I was, as a statistician, try to help you answer that question. The first thing I would be saying is, okay, tell me what you really mean by better.
Well, better is real simple. You know, I have X value and in 1 year I want X plus.
Right. Okay. So that's an easy way to define that here. And then we'd have to figure out some way to collect the data. But my job as a statistician would be just to analyze the data at the end and give you the result of the analysis. And I wouldn't be able to make a guess ahead of time. That's a Bayesian statistic.
That's right. I mean, it's interesting.
Makes a guess before.
His best would be different, for example, from mine. My best would be, hey, there's a certain amount that I need. And now how to get to that certain amount without having to worry day in, day out and pay attention to anything. And that would be best for me, right? Yeah. I mean, so it's interesting. Have you ever done much work on actuarial life expectancies?
Well, interestingly, no, but my daughter is a freshman at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln, in actuarial science.
Oh.
So I did, and I, like I told you, I originally started out thinking that was where I was going to go. I did do a little bit of preliminary, you know, looked at the first actuarial exam, that kind of thing. But I got the research bug before I got much farther than that.
So. Well, there's one statistic that concerns me, which is the reason I'm still working, maybe. There's the fact that the life expectancy of white Anglo-Saxon males after retirement is something around 2 years. Right, and this is a grim statistic that is thrown out, and people say, "Oh, it comes from the military, it comes from actuarial studies on insurance companies, and all these other things." I'd like you to go back and do some research on that, because I don't know whether to retire this year or wait a few.
You're going to have to write me into a grant here. I'll need some support to analyze that question.
From my point, I want you to do a study on super beets. Juice, which says that you'll feel 10 years younger as soon as you start using Super Beets.
That's a commercial.
Do companies for advertising, have anything to do with what you're doing?
Well, I think that would depend on how ethical the company is.
You mean if they didn't like the results, they would bury them instead of...
Luckily, I've never been in the situation where I've had to make an ethical consideration. Anytime I've been helping a researcher, I've just presented the results, and if they weren't what they wanted, oh, well, I have to go back to the drawing board.
One of the questions that I often ask, and my wife gets quite angry, because I say, you know, where's your funding coming from? I mean, to do your original work, you've got to get money from somewhere. Where does funding come from for the basic research and statistics that you're interested in?
Well, statisticians, they're research programs, obviously we can do part of our research just as our regular, my salary. I don't have to have a lab because I don't need to. My statistical research is dealing with how numbers behave.
Right.
So I usually, my data sets involve simulations. I just set my computer up and tell it to run and it runs.
But you don't have a research group of graduate students that you need to fund it?
That's correct. Now, I do have graduate students that work with me,
right.
But it's just one-on-one. I don't have to have a whole lot of students to run a lab.
And you don't have to fund them?
No. Well, we do. We have those are funded mostly on teaching assistantships.
Okay.
So now we do have research assistants, and we do, you know, we can apply for NSF grants just like everybody else and get, but those are not. There's this, the pot of money for statistical research is less because we
unless
have
unless you're collaborating with people
right,
that are getting now, genome data sets
right.
And all the rest
where
of it.
Most statisticians get their research money is that they are, I won't say a co-PI, but they are a collaborator on a science grant that's dealing with genomics data.
Okay.
And so they are providing the statistical support. And often that leads to a statistical research question also.
But, I mean, having said that, do you see the reality in there anywhere?
Statisticians in math departments have a harder job. They have to, there's almost always a bunch of mathematicians who think theoretical math on wavelets and measure theory and those sorts of concepts are the only things that are important enough to be called real work.
Mindy McCann from Oklahoma State University, Department of Statistics. It's been a pleasure. You're very good at talking about something that most people don't really have a good grasp on, and I thank you for that.
Yes, and we really would like to thank Norma Martinez, our producer.
And thank you for listening, and we'll be back next week with another Science Studio, so you be there. Bye-bye.